Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the very first day of July. We're going to be looking at No Child Left Behind, the first hour of our program today. 156 schools and four school districts in Wisconsin were cited recently for not making adequate yearly progress under this law. This is a 64% increase over schools that received preliminary notices in the year 2007. And about one-third of the schools, 56 of the schools, could face federal sanctions because they've missed the same progress targets for 2 years or more. Why the number of state schools here so high? The state deputy superintendent of public instruction, Tony Evers, said that he believes most of the increase occurred because of a rise in standards and not a decline in student performance. State test scores have been relatively stable for the past several years. This year, progress standards were tougher for the first time in 3 years as the state of Wisconsin moves toward this goal of 100% of all students being proficient by the year 2013-2014. We'll be talking about this, and I know there are many of you who are educators who listen to Wisconsin Public Radio and have thoughts about No Child Left Behind and how it's affecting you in the classroom. Our guest is Professor Gene Williams, Professor of Education Studies and Chair of the Educational Studies Department at Ripon College. Her special interest areas include literacy development, classroom culture, and teacher decision making, also educational ethnographics. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. Or if you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. And send an email if you'd like. That address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Gene Williams, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
How do you explain that 64% increase over last year? That's pretty big.
It's two things. It's rising standards. State testing standards were raised, so we're actually comparing apples and oranges. Kids last year were tested against a different standard. The second is that we're moving into a period in No Child Left Behind where schools are required to disaggregate their data. And the first time I heard that, I thought that the term was desegregate the data, and I thought that was very strange, but it's disaggregate. And what that means is they're not only reporting on overall student performance, but performance of students in various categories. So special ed students have to be reported out separately. English language learners have to be reported out separately. And if any one of those groups doesn't make the standard, then the school is found to be not in compliance.
Isn't it hard for some of those who don't speak English as a first language, those exceptional education students? I would imagine that it takes longer than a few years for those students to be 100% proficient, if they ever will be.
If they ever will be. And that's, I think, the huge issue that this year's reports are bringing to light. The assumption that 100% of students can reach those proficiency standards when, by definition, students who are learning disabled, students who have mild cognitive dysfunction, et cetera, are probably never going to meet those standards.
Mm-hmm. So why is that a part of the law, then?
I think it was an attempt, and a well-intentioned attempt, to deal with the inequalities that are sort of endemic in the system, that certain groups of kids seem to be left behind and covered up in data that just reports on general scores. And mm-hmm. So the attempt of the legislation was to say, we're going to make you report out on students in these various categories so that we can be sure that they're not getting lost in the general data. And that's a well-intentioned idea, but in reality, it assumes that 100% proficiency is possible for those students. Now, I should also make clear that there is a provision in the law that students who have in their individualized education plan or IEP certain restrictions on the kinds of assessments can be assessed using a different tool, and students with very severe cognitive disabilities are excluded from the testing.
I see.
But a lot of kids who are under individualized education plans, because for various reasons, are still in the mix, and then their scores are pulled out and reported separately. So for a school district like Milwaukee, they don't just have targets in reading and math. They have 40. They can have up to 40 different targets.
Oh my gosh!
Because they have to report out for various groups. So Rufus King, which is the school that's in the news because it was in Newsweek as one of the best high schools in the state, and is now on warning. It's really based on some very small categories of students. Their overall performance of the school meets the standards, but it's the reporting out on those various subgroups that puts them in noncompliance.
Mm-hmm. And the principal of that school was quoted as saying, when the federal government and the DPI expect children with education needs to be proficient at the same level as regular education kids, I think it's something that they need to rethink.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the Milwaukee Journal this morning took on that same issue, and the last sentence in that editorial is that the federal government should make sure that the standards it imposes are fair, and, by the way, that the mandates are fully funded, mm-hmm. which they're not.
Mm-hmm. What about these rising standards? How are we getting different standards, and are standards rising all over the country in every state?
Yes, in part because what we're getting now is years of data about how students are performing on these tests. And so the states themselves set the standards for what is proficient. And as that data rolls in and it's reconsidered by the states, they can move the standards. And so in the state of Wisconsin, we bumped the standards up. And again, that sort of gives us a moving target that we're trying to hit. But the responsibility for setting the standards lies at the state level.
Mm-hmm. And when you say, Professor Williams, that people are complaining it's not fully funded, what's not funded?
One estimate by a professor of educational finance is that it would take a 30% increase in funding for the states to be able to fully carry out all of the mandates in No Child Left Behind. So there are mandates for parent education. There are mandates for paying if a school is labeled as a failing school and students want to transfer out of that school, then the school must send their money with them. And so that has to be funded so that schools can pay for their students to essentially to leave the school. The whole testing program is not completely funded. The kinds of tutoring and remedial work that are called for in the law are not fully funded.
Mm-hmm. Making it difficult to achieve those standards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What happens? MPS, of course, has been cited first as having the largest presence on the list of schools in Wisconsin and also as a district that's been identified for improvement for the second year. What happens after 2 years to a school? What happens after three? Can you transfer out?
Once the school, now at this point they're just labeled as needing improvement, and there's several more steps in the process before a school is labeled as failing. When a school is labeled as failing, then parents and community members have to receive notification of that. And at that point, parents have the option of transferring their students out to another school.
And you are identified as failing, certainly as a result of the proficiency scores, but also if you've not met them for a certain number of years.
Right.
And how many years is that?
I think it's 3 to 4. I'm not actually sure on that. I know what the steps are, but I'm not sure how many years.
Mm-hmm. When is this law going to be looked at very carefully by Congress? Is it up for renewal?
It's up for renewal now.
Right now it is.
So it's being discussed now. And so in the next 2 years. And this is essentially, it's important to remember the history of this. This is essentially a reauthorization of the original legislation passed in 1965, which was the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which was really the first time that the federal government ever got involved in public education, which had always been a state function. ESEA was trying to, remember, was part of Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, and the attempt was to make the schools accountable for educating kids regardless of social class or background.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the reauthorization of that act, which comes up about every 5 years for renewal. what it marks is the first time that the federal government has set the standards for what is determined to be success or non-success.
Remember also
that still the vast majority of the funding of public education comes from state and local sources.
Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, the No Child Left Behind law or act initially had a great deal of bipartisan support, didn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it came out of the Education Committee, and it was supported by both parties, Ted Kennedy on the Democratic mm-hmm. side, and I believe Phil Graham on the Republican side, but I can't remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Bit of information. It had strong bipartisan support. It really represents two sort of politically competing agendas, the equity agenda from the liberal side and the accountability agenda from the more conservative side, and those two are married in this law. So you see that emphasis on trying to close the achievement gap, and that that language has become sort of part of the talk of school. And then the accountability, the notion that the schools have to be accountable to the public for the achievement of students.
If you listen to the candidates, particularly the Democratic candidates running for president, you would be led to believe that it no longer has bipartisan support.
I think that's probably true, and I think it's probably true that support is eroding on both sides because of problems at the local level.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them momentarily. I have a feeling our lines will be quite crowded because this affects many of you in our audience, students and teachers and, well, the whole country, actually. Professor Gene Williams is our guest. These results just came out recently looking at schools and districts in Wisconsin that have not made adequate yearly progress under No Child Left Behind. 156 schools, 4 school districts in the state of Wisconsin. 56 could face federal sanctions because they've missed the same progress targets for 2 or more years. There were 82 schools in MPS that were cited, 8 schools in the Racine Unified School District. There were also schools in Madison that were listed in No Child Left Behind, and the Madison School District for the first time actually was among those falling short of the criteria for adequate yearly progress. Give us your thoughts on this, and some of you are directly affected by it. A couple lines are open for you at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers 414-227-2050, or you can use that email, which is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Barbara Ehrenreich will be our guest. She has a new book, a series of very provocative essays, This Land Is Their Land. Barbara Ehrenreich after 10 today. Professor Gene Williams, Professor of Education Studies, Chair of the Educational Studies Department at Ripon College, is our guest this hour as we look at No Child Left Behind and start our calls with Carl from Beaver Dam. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I'd just like to point out that the real purpose of the Bush administration wasn't to improve education, public education, but to destroy it by setting up impossible standards that no school could ever reach when it gets to 100%. And then they could point to it and say, see, we told you these schools were lousy, and that would give them the justification to privatize it. And that was really the real purpose behind it. And, in fact, this has recently been admitted by a former Bush administration official who was involved in setting up these standards and the benchmarks, and she has actually admitted that that was the case.
You agree with that, Professor Williams?
That's an argument that's been made. Alfie Cohn, for one person, has made the argument that, in fact, that was the political agenda. I think it's important to note, however, that when it became, in the process of this becoming a bill, if that was the agenda, and I'm not inside the minds of those people, so I don't know if it was, but that when as it went through the progress of becoming law and the compromises had to be made that had to be made for it to become law, that some of the attempt was to try to make sure that it wouldn't do that. Now, unfortunately, when they set the 100% proficiency standard, they made very clear that no school, and we see that across the country, that the number of schools being cited as not in compliance rises every single year.
Hmm. Thank you very much, Carl, for your call. Jim from Marshfield, hi.
Oh, hello. I wish to give an example, which perhaps your guests can comment on. My mother worked as a school teacher in the 27th Street School. That's on 27th and Wisconsin Avenue in Milwaukee. And her principal, Mr. Burke, was appointed by the local Democrat Party, and instead of the people who run the school system. And I wondered how often it is that in the big cities, which are predominantly run by the Democrat Party, that the schools of education and the school boards are sidestepped in this sort of political appointment process.
When did that happen? I never have heard of this happening. It goes through the superintendent.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But in this case, it didn't. And I was curious as to how widespread a practice this is.
When was that?
Oh, it would have been back in the 1980s.
Yeah, I'm not at all aware of principals being appointed by any party, Democratic Party or Republican Party. Are you, Professor Williams?
No.
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 Colin is next from Eau Claire. Hi, Colin.
Hello. Fan of the show, by the way.
Thanks.
My girlfriend is in not special education, but she's a elementary education major at UW-Eau Claire. And one of the things she points out is that special ed students are now being included in the classroom as well as gifted students. So the average scores, it would seem, would be impossible to get 100% proficiency when you're lumping in students with special needs. And it seems like this is kind of a self-defeating purpose. If one practice is going to take place where another practice will also take place, expecting the standards of students all over to be 100% while you're also not setting aside different standards for obviously a special interest of students. So I guess I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks, Colin. Professor Williams.
Yeah, I think we can agree that it's very clear that setting 100% proficiency and then applying that standard to special ed populations just doesn't make sense. It also, lest we forget it, doesn't really make sense for those kids who are not in special ed, which my colleague Andy Kirkmeyer refers to the great unspecial, that group of kids who aren't in gifted programs, aren't in special ed programs, but run the gamut of achievement and abilities. When you take a human population, you're going to get a spread of intelligence and abilities in a variety of different ways. To expect all of them to reach 100% proficiency just flies in the face of everything we know about human performance.
I've heard a lot of teachers complain, and administrators as well, Professor Williams, that No Child Left Behind has really changed education in a fundamental way, so that what teachers are doing are spending a great deal of time making sure that students are prepared for the mm-hmm. tests, that they give them sample areas of this could be what you could find, this is how you need to deal with this test. You're in doing preparation for mm-hmm. this, you're skipping mm-hmm. World War II, maybe.
Yeah, I can tell you two things that I see as I'm out in the schools, and I supervise student teachers every year, every semester, so I'm not divorced from the public school scene. Two things that I've seen lately that I think are directly related to the emphasis on testing and the need for the districts to meet these targets. One is the push down of the curriculum into lower and lower levels, so that I've been in kindergarten classrooms where there's no longer playtime, where mm-hmm. kids are mm-hmm. involved in literacy instruction for 2.5 or 3 hours, where time outside has been limited. And I think that we're seeing that a lot in the state with the push down of the curriculum to lower and lower levels. Mm-hmm. We have to get kids started earlier, mm-hmm. earlier and earlier. The other thing that I see is curriculum that tends to be more factual. There's much more emphasis on coverage. It's the thing that secondary teachers, and especially creative and earnest secondary teachers who really want their students to enjoy the discipline, to get a sense of what history is, for instance, who feel that they must cover material. And that notion of coverage has become very important because you have to look at what's on the test and try to anticipate what the kids need to know. So depth of coverage or depth of exploration of material is getting lost. And I think those are two of the things that we're seeing. Yeah, almost, I would bet, in every district in
right.
the state.
Well, that's significant, isn't it?
Yes, because it means, I think, that teachers feel that they are less in control.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in terms of the morale of teachers, it means that they feel that they are less trusted to make decisions about what content to cover. And the depth of content, the kinds of activities that they can take time for in the classroom.
Which in turn may make students less engaged in the learning process
mm-hmm.
and maybe a little more bored, huh?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Pat is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a good friend who, I have several friends that are teachers, but I have a good friend who taught in MPS for like 17 years, and now she's teaching up in St. Paul. Her family is up there. And one of the things that she constantly complained about was the fact that you can't teach a child if they're not in their desk. And she said that she's finding in St. Paul what they do is they actually have staff that go out into the community, to the kids' house, and talk with the parents about getting their kids to school. Because one of the issues is that among the poor, they don't have landphones. They have the cell phones, and you can't just make a call. It's very impossible to get in touch with the parents. So they, St. Paul has taken up this fight of doing it that way. But she was very frustrated with the fact that she can't be teaching kids that are not there, and then of course they take the test, and it brings down the average scores.
Sure.
And I think one of the other critiques of No Child Left Behind is that it assumes that the school can somehow overcome some pretty deep inequities in the culture. And you can't teach kids who aren't in their desk. You can't teach kids who don't have enough to eat. You can't teach kids who are sick. You can't teach kids who are worried about what's going on and whether they're going to be in the same house next week that they're in this week. The impact of poverty on educational achievement is clear, has been clearly demonstrated in research for 30 years. So No Child Left Behind tries to assert that the schools should be able to overcome the effects of poverty just in their institution, just the institution of the schools. And I think that there's no research that suggests that the schools are strong enough to do that, a strong enough institution to do that. Then when you look at the inequity in funding in schools and you look at, for instance, the difference in the funding of children in Milwaukee versus children in the northern suburbs of Milwaukee, we're looking sometimes at disparities on a, five, six times the amount of money spent per child in some of the northern suburbs versus kids in Milwaukee. So you're asking schools that are underfunded to overcome the effects of poverty, and that seems to me, just on the face of it, to be expecting too much.
Mm. And the effects of poverty are second hour focus today, too. If this program were fully funded, would some of those effects of poverty be negated?
Some of them, maybe, and maybe teachers would feel strong. Teachers would feel empowered to teach more effectively, but I think unless we look at achievement targets that make sense, no, it's not going to overcome the effect of poverty on kids' ability to achieve in school to an extent that will allow us to achieve 100% proficiency.
You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're talking about the No Child Left Behind law and the 156 schools and four districts in Wisconsin who were cited recently for not making adequate yearly progress under this law. And welcoming your phone calls, Professor Gene Williams, Professor of Education Studies and Chair of the Educational Studies Program at Ripon College, is our guest. Our next caller is Marge from Duluth. Hi, Marge.
Hi, I just want to mention that one of the things that has really gotten very convoluted in this whole discussion is the fact that the union is in control of who is in the classroom. And the issue is, it is impossible to fire an incompetent teacher. So part of the reason for No Child Left Behind was to show what these schools are or aren't doing. And yes, indeed, there are certainly areas where No Child Left Behind should be tweaked and improved, and certainly the issue of disadvantaged kids and handicapped kids, that is a category that needs to be addressed with perhaps additional funding and concern. But you can't lose in the discussion, and it does happen always, the fact that it was an attempt to hold teachers accountable for what they're doing in the classroom, because once a teacher has tenure, that teacher can roost in that classroom forever, whether students are taught or not.
Professor Williams.
Yes. No Child Left Behind at no point holds individual teachers accountable. That's not the way the data is reported, and it's it is up to schools to internally look at the data and look at teachers. The teachers' union has come out full force, actually, against No Child Left Behind. That seems to me perfectly predictable that would happen. The firing of incompetent teachers has always been a problem. There has to be a case made, and how that can be done without a strong system of looking at teacher performance is really problematic. But No Child Left Behind actually did very little to empower school districts to deal with the question of incompetent teachers. There's just not very much in the law that actually addresses that issue, and it is the teacher training, teacher improvement parts of the law are simply not funded.
The schools that aren't doing very well, I think Marge would put the blame at teachers. The teachers are not performing very well, thus the students are not going to perform very well on the tests or in the classroom at all, that the union is protecting a bunch of bad teachers.
And I hear that argument all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when the Gallup poll of public perception of education for 30 years, consistently, when you ask about the quality of teachers, people rate the teachers and the schools in their home district at an A or a B level and rate them at the national level at a C or a D level. The perception is that there are incompetent teachers in other school districts, but not in ours.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is. Yeah. I think that's one of the most interesting pieces of educational statistics we have.
Thanks, Marge, for the call. Mary from Belleville. Hi, Mary.
At a 49% turnover.
Mary, are you there?
1 year.
Hello? I've turned that radio down. Hi, Mary.
Yes. I just wanted to say that for 20 years I worked in a program that served immigrant children and very, very poor, the poorest children of the city, black and white. We had a 49% turnover in one school year. I mean, this happened every year, but within a school year, 49%. So to measure what we were doing is difficult because we're not dealing with the same children year after year.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how good a job we did, we always had an incoming group that needed services.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of the fallacies of the testing mandate of No Child Left Behind that we're always going to compare last year's group with the next year's group. And yet we all know that classes have personalities, that the group of children coming through a school will vary from year to year. And in those schools that experience a lot of movement, that you're not even talking about similar groups from year to year or the same children from year to year. So you can't look at how kids were doing in fourth grade and how they're doing in 10th grade because they're not the same kids. That's true in Milwaukee. I know it's true in Beloit, and to some extent in Madison, that when you have kids moving from place to place, who is accountable for them? Is it the school that had them last year, the school that has them this year? There's such a disruption in their education that it's hard to imagine that we could hold any one teacher accountable for what's going on there.
That is a huge turnover rate, 49%. Is that unusual?
Yeah, it is huge. It is huge. And yet there I have former students teaching in Milwaukee who experience that kind of turnover rate on a regular basis.
My. Thank you, Mary.
Kids moving from place to place.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mary, for your call. Susan from Sussex. Hi. Hello, Susan.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'm calling because I have a son with autism who's in the special ed program. He's out of the school district now. He's old enough. But what I remember is several years ago when the research was showing the, you know, the multiple intelligences and teaching to children's abilities instead of just, you know, one way to teach for all the children. And it, at least in our districts, it, you know, it was being implemented. The teachers were being taught. And there was a lot of excitement. And, you know, the changes that my son was in a lot of inclusion programs, so he was in the classroom. But the changes that they made for him applied very much to the population in general. And it's very exciting. And you cannot expect, you know, children that have dyslexia to be able to read the test. Or, you know, so these invisible problems that, are showing up and assessing them in a different way and doing multiple assessments. And it was a wonderful idea. But what No Child Is Left Behind has done is taken that away. And I find the teachers so much more depressed about not being able to incorporate these new ideas that had testing behind them that showed that they were, working. And now they're forced to teach to the test. It's very, very frustrating.
I think it is. I do want to point out that there is some evidence. There are some folks at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, in particular Professor Colleen Capper, who have been looking for the last couple of years at schools that have succeeded in closing the achievement gap. And what she looked at was how those schools were working with children who might be labeled as having some kind of educational disadvantage, either special ed, kids coming out of poverty, kids who are ELL. And she was really looking at schools that were using inclusion to address those issues rather than segregating those kids into special programs, putting them into the classroom. And what she found was that strong principal leadership is a key factor, but also working with teachers to help them to differentiate instruction in their classroom so that they were using strategies that allowed kids to work from their strengths, and that not only helped the kids, you know, the targeted kids from special populations, it also meant that the entire classroom was more effective in terms of student learning, that you bring more personnel into the classroom, you allow the regular classroom teacher to have access to the expertise of the special ed folks, of the ELL folks, and it develops an inclusive classroom that is really focused on student achievement. These teachers were not teaching to the test. The fact that the kids in these schools performed better on the test was a byproduct of very good instruction, not a limiting of the curriculum, but an enriching of the curriculum. And I think that's very exciting research that we really need to begin to ask ourselves the question, if we narrow the curriculum, if we narrow the range of teaching strategies used in the classroom, is that really going to achieve what we want, or do we more clearly need to focus on the needs of individual children and the kind of instruction that will allow kids to play to their strengths?
Thank you, Susan, for your call. Craig is next from McFarland. Hi, Craig.
Hi.
Hi.
My take on this, it's just a kind of a comment and opinion. There's a known correlation in where people locate their residence in regards to the local education or perceived education that their kids are going to receive. And I happen to be in the Madison area, and a lot of people are locating in the surrounding suburbs, which are perceived to have less of a political bias in their education system. I'm not saying that's the only reason they're locating there, but school quality and the education their kids are going to get are, you know, a huge factor in where people locate. And I just think that in some cases, we know that some of the schools in Madison have not made the criteria for No Child Left Behind. That was just in the paper within the last 2 weeks. And I just see it as a deteriorating situation as long as there's a real bias or political agenda, which is put forth by a lot of the educators, where people rebel by moving or not locating there in the first place. And then what you end up with are people who, for whatever reason, proximity to transportation and things like that, stay and are penalized. And I guess it isn't necessarily a union situation because the schools in the surrounding districts are mostly union teachers as well. Mm-hmm. But I think that the political agenda, I mean, I know a lot of people, I know this is anecdotal, but there's a lot of people who just will not put their kids into the Madison School District, as an example, because of the perceived, in this particular case, left-wing bias that they receive.
All right. Thanks for your call, Professor Williams.
Yeah, I don't know about perceived left-wing bias, but I do think that there is very strong evidence that we've seen a resegregation of the public schools, not only along racial lines, but along social class lines. So the districts like Milwaukee and Madison are dealing with very diverse populations, high impact of poverty in those schools. And there is a perception, and I think, you know, when you publish a list that shows many of the Milwaukee public schools have been identified as not meeting the standards, that plays into the perception that those schools are failing, even though what we know, when you unpackage that data, is that they may be failing on only one dimension with one group of students. So I think part of the problem with No Child Left Behind is that it exacerbates the problem of those schools that are dealing with populations that have special needs, that with high poverty, and by labeling, continuing to publicly label them as failing without any intervention to try to deal with the problems, makes it more likely that people are going to flee from those schools as they've been doing for the last 30 years.
Craig, thanks for the call. We'll take more phone calls in just one moment. We're talking this hour of our program about No Child Left Behind and the number of Wisconsin schools who have not made progress targets in 2007 and 2008. Professor Gene Williams, professor of education studies and chair of the Educational Studies Department at Ripon College, is our guest. And our phone number, one line is open, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Milwaukee callers 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Barbara Ehrenreich will be our guest. Her latest book, a series of essays, This Land is Their Land. All right, back to phone calls for Professor Gene Williams, No Child Left Behind, and the number of schools in Wisconsin who have not met the progress report required of the law is what we're talking about this hour of the show. Pat from Brantwood, hi.
Yes, hi, Kathleen. This is such a wonderful show, and I'm so glad you're having it. I agree with most of the points that Professor Williams is making. But I wanted to respond to the teacher, or to the person from Duluth, who said that the unions are part of the problem, and in some ways maybe they are, but not to keep teachers from being removed, because right now they have at least 3 years of observation and evaluation and meeting criteria before they get tenure, so they can be let go for no reason in that time. And they can be helped, they can be assisted to be better teachers or told that they might be happier in another profession. And so there's really no excuse to have poor teachers on staff anymore. Principals and other people in charge need to do their job in evaluating these young people that are coming. And then the second point I wanted to make is that there needs to be some responsibility put on parents, as a previous caller said, to have their children in school and children to be there and to work hard and listen and behave and not be on their cell phones or games or whatever while they're there, because the whole responsibility cannot be on the school system and the teachers. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Thank you, Pat.
Let me respond to the first one. I think it is important to recognize that there is a three-year probation period before anyone is tenured in a school district, and that there needs to be mentoring of new teachers. Beyond that, I would add that the new state licensure requirements that went into effect in 2004 require that teachers have a professional development plan in place and that they actively work that plan in order to get their license renewed at a five-year interval. I think that gives another option for school districts to work with teachers to try to improve the quality of teaching. And then as licensure proceeds, there are, you know, the similar kinds of steps have to be taken. So I think there are a number of ways for people to, for administrators to work with teachers in the school system for continual improvement. Working with parents is, of course, a part, and helping kids to recognize their responsibility in terms of their achievement in schools is something that has to happen along with holding teachers accountable. I think that what was mentioned about St. Paul actively going out to find students who are not in schools is one way to do that. It is complicated at this point by the fact that families are mobile, that landline phones aren't available, phone numbers change rapidly for some folks. And so we're talking about a situation where keeping in contact with families can be a very difficult thing. Part of what No Child Left Behind did mandate was greater community involvement in schools and setting goals, but again, not funded. And for the federal government to issue a mandate for programming and then not fund it means that, state and local districts have to pick up that funding if they're going to do that. And it hasn't been possible given the current economic situation.
Mm-hmm. Jeff from Winneconne, hi.
Yeah, what we need is more teachers, and that's obvious. I had five kids. I noticed it all the way through my whole life. So did my wife, that these kids were being undereducated. They weren't taking the time. Classic example is taking physics and sex education out of the educational system. We need to go down to about 14 kids per classroom, and then maybe our children will be educated properly.
That would be ideal. I don't think there aren't too many classrooms that have that ratio.
I have many students looking for jobs right now, so I'm not going to argue with that.
It's hard to argue that a smaller classroom size doesn't make a difference.
It is hard to argue. It is the ultimate argument when people talk about the achievement of homeschooled children as opposed to those in schools. And, you know, one of the answers to that is if I had a 2-to-1 student-to-teacher ratio for every kid in the country, we wouldn't have a crisis in the schools. Yes. And obviously, when you're dealing with kids who bring problems and issues to the table, classroom size matters, and we ought to be looking at that very closely.
Thanks, Jeff, for your call. Reed from Clintonville, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for this opportunity. And first off, let me say that I've heard from at least two callers, a gentleman from Madison and a woman prior to him from Duluth, who make broad generalizations about teachers in general. And there are not only a few bad teachers, and I would certainly admit that because I was a teacher for many years, but there are so many more good teachers. They are far and away outnumber bad teachers. But as far as I know, there are no tenured public school teachers in the state of Wisconsin, and perhaps your guest can speak to that issue. There is a tenure program or a tenure procedure for college and university people, mm-hmm. and it's an extremely rigorous procedure before they can become tenured. Teachers do have to, new teachers have to undergo a probation period. Mm-hmm. And then they are assessed as to whether or not they will be retained. But that is not a tenured position. And I might add there are also a very high number, as far as I'm concerned, of bad administrators. There are bad principals. There are bad superintendents. And just as there are bad teachers. And for people to make bad or generalizations about teachers being the only problem. If that woman that made that generalization had a mandate from the federal government or the state government or a local government that she must keep her porch lights on all night, but they wouldn't help pay for that electricity bill, I think she'd be up in arms. And that's exactly what's happening to schools around the state. We have this mandate of No Child Left Behind, but there's no money to support it. Schools are now discontinuing programs such as art and music. They're asking parents and other community organizations to help fund sports programs. So I would say that by and large, I think our teachers in the state of Wisconsin are doing an exemplary job.
Thanks, Reed, for the call. Professor Williams.
Yes, one of the things I'd point out is that one of the ironies of No Child Left Behind is that states like Minnesota and Wisconsin, which are continuously, top, with Iowa 1, 2, 3 in the nation in terms of student scores on ACT scores, student achievement scores, have already set high standards for students. And yes, there is an achievement gap, and that is a problem that I think we have a moral obligation to address. But the fact of the matter is, to paint the public school system overall as a failure, to paint teachers overall as a failure, flies in the face of that information, which says that our schools are doing some things quite well.
Thanks for the call, and let's go next to, and we have a couple lines open, and if you want to squeeze in a call, 800-486-8655. Mark from Nina, hi.
Hi. One of the questions I have or comments I have is about teachers not being addressed through No Child Left Behind. The teachers who are hired as coaches, we forget about, the community support that gets rallied around a winning team and the perception that gets created of how good school is doing because we got a winning team, but fail to look at those people who are hired truly as coaches and don't meet the mustard in the classroom.
Yes, there are teachers who are hired for coaching abilities, but I think it's also important in the state of Wisconsin to understand that coaching contracts and teaching contracts are not necessarily linked together. So that would not prevent a school, should not prevent a school from dealing with the person's qualifications in the classroom. Wisconsin also allows people who are not full-time teachers to be coaches. My son's cross-country coach for several years is not a teacher in the district, just someone who comes in and coaches cross-country very well, I might add. So I think that we need to try to break that link between teachers and coaching and allow the two things to be handled and to be addressed separately. My experience with my students going out into teaching positions is that sometimes the coaching drives the hiring, and that's not the best thing for kids academically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on the other hand, I know some coaches who are great teachers mm-hmm. as well. So
right.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your call. Give me a timeline again here, Professor Williams, as to how this law, what considerations are underway to change parts of this law, when it's going to be voted on?
It's in hearing now, and this is a good time for people to have input to congressmen and senators, because it is being discussed at this point. The chief state school officers group that Superintendent Burmaster was head of last year is trying to have some influence on that process. So it's a good time to contact your senators and your congresspeople and talk to them about the law and what you think of it. I think it's scheduled to come up for hearings in the next congressional session.
Mm-hmm.
I think a very particular issue to be brought up is the issue of funding, but I think also that people need to have some input into the question of how we're going to measure achievement. There are other ways of measuring achievement other than just using standardized tests, and even standardized tests can be used in different ways to look at student growth over time rather than setting a particular standard as being the absolute zenith of what we want students to achieve. So I think that now is the time to have input into this. It's going to be discussed over the next year, and I think will be an issue in the presidential campaign.
Oh, I'm sure you're right. And would you say that teachers and parents have already had a lot of input?
I would say not.
Really?
I think that teachers and parents have not really been active in the way that the law was shaped.
Mm.
I think at the state level, there is an attempt to try to keep teachers involved in those boards and committees that are helping to set the standards for the state. But I think it needs to be more.
Okay.
And I think especially those folks who are parents of special ed kids and kids of poverty we need to go out and reach those people and bring.
And on that point, we have to say goodbye. Thank you very much for being with us, Professor Jean Williams, professor of education studies and chair of the educational studies department at Ripon College. Thanks to John Anderson for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. News ahead from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more Tuesday Conversation here on the Ideas Network.